Hey listeners, are you a fan of true crime? If you are listening to this podcast, then you most certainly are. During these strange times, are you looking for a new true crime podcast? Then you have found your new true crime obsession. My podcast, Riddle Me That True Crime, covers both older cases as well as current ones. I cover both well-known and more obscure cases, such as the strange death of Blair Adams, the cyanide coffee murder of Myrna Salihin, and the disappearance of Sri Lanka's richest man, Upali Wijewardene. Riddle Me That True Crime is available on Apple, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you. Now back to the show.
Hi, y'all, and welcome to Kudzu Killers, Homicide, and Sweet Tea, where we like to share gothic tales of Southern-style murder.
I'm Lark, and that other voice you hear is Kim. Each week, we take turns telling you the gruesome details of serial killers, spree killers, and just plain old mean people that we find interesting, and we hope you do too. Sometimes quirky and weird, but always respectful.
So sit back, grab your glass of iced tea, relax, and let us take you step by step through our story. And feel free to shoot us a comment on a specific episode on our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com.
Now, let's get on with the show.
I'd like to give a shout out to Conway, who tells us he is in the frozen tundra of Yankee Land.
Hey, Conway!
Hey, Conway. And that we had him at the title of our podcast. So he's going to give us a listen, and I hope he's listening this week. Thanks, Conway. Thanks for the comment.
Thanks, Kim. And today, what I want to talk about is, I don't know if y'all have noticed, but I like more historical kind of crimes. Kim likes contemporary ones, and I like old-fashioned-y stuff. So we're going to talk about a lady that was born in the 20s. You know, in the age of online dating, things really haven't changed much from years ago when there were Lonely Hearts ads in the paper or romance magazines. Love and the pursuit of love seem to be most everyone's weakness or Achilles heel. I mean, nowadays, you have to watch out for the catfish scammers and Nigerian princes. But back in the day, apparently, you had to watch out for murder, too.
Yikes.
So today's story is about a lady, a woman, that had lots of nicknames in the press and with the police. She was dubbed the Giggling Grandma. And I gotta say, she kind of looks like my grandma and every other little old grandma at that time. She was also called the Lonely Hearts Killer, the Jolly Black Widow, and even Lady Bluebeard. But my personal favorite, you guys, is she is called the Self-Made Widow. I love that. The Self-Made Widow.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now, Nancy Doss, nicknamed Nanny, left a wake of bodies behind her as she moved from state to state and from relative to relative. And she was linked to the murders of, okay, get this now, because we're going to come back, tick them off, four husbands, her mother, two mother-in-laws, two sisters, two of her children, a grandchild, and a nephew. Okay?
So, oh, jeez.
So she had a successful 30-year murder spree in several states across the South before
That's 13 people. Did I get that right? 13 people?
I didn't count them up, but let's see, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, yep. And a couple of them got them away, but those were the actual
ones. Well, good for them.
Yeah. Two different guys actually got away. But anyhow, so, like I say, it really was the span of 30 years murder spree. And then they finally got her. Okay, so filling in the details. Nanny spent most of her life chasing a fantasy of romance. Knights and shining armor and sex. and reading Pulp Magazine's True Romance. I think basically to escape the horrible abuses that she'd taken from her stepfather and her husbands. And now Kim and I can tell you that none of that is real.
Yeah, we can tell you that.
Yep, because both Kim and I used to write for True Romance magazine. So that's another story that we're happy to talk about if you want to drop us some questions.
Yeah, the true part of it was a little bit, you know, untrue.
The true part is that we truly wrote it. And it truly came from our imaginations. But
yeah, they were not nonfiction stories, at least during the age when we wrote for them, they weren't.
Right. And who knows?
So that's an interesting little tidbit everybody knows about us now, that we used to write true romance short stories.
Well, we used to write all kinds of stuff, and we still do. And we'll let y'all know more about that, too, and because we have a lot of other facets to our personality. But meanwhile, back to our nanny. So Nanny was the daughter of Dixie, born November the 4th, 1905, in Blue Mountain, Alabama, which is now part of Anniston, Alabama. And she was originally Nanny Hazel, and she had been molested by a string of local men before she really reached her mid-teens, and speculated that pretty much she showed up on her daddy's doorstep or her stepfather's doorstep with her mom, and he wasn't even her real daddy. So she and her siblings had a pretty hard life from childhood on, and with little to no education and harsh, really harsh discipline from her stepfather, whose name is James Hazel. And as Nanny entered the dating age, she was held back from these testosterone-filled boys of Calhoun County, Alabama, by Mr. James Hazel, who saw Nanny and her three sisters as farm and field hands, and he wasn't too eager to give them up. So
free labor.
Oh no! Yeah. Oh yeah. So he forbade them from attending the church socials and the Saturday night hootenannies, and makeup was like totally outlawed. Are you kidding? And silk stockings were considered sinful. Of course, I don't think they could afford it, anything like that. And fixed hair was just hell bent. Right. And form-fitting dresses were absolutely slutty, girl. So no daughter of his was going to tempt the male libido, okay?
Right.
So he often reminded these girls that when the time came, that he'd pick those husbands for his daughters. So even though, you know, her daddy was so harsh like that, Nanny did, however, manage to sneak away here and there into the hayloft or the corn crib. And the boys liked her because she was pretty. You know, she was shapely you know, she was pretty. She had dark hair and pretty eyes. And she had this giggle, which kind of pervades the rest of her life. I mean, she just giggled.
Which is why she's called the giggling granny.
Well, it's part of it. Yeah, I think it's her personality. And she was just, I don't think she ever really passed the mentality of, I'm speculating here, because of the way that she was abused at a young age. And she knew that if she giggled and played this little girl card, that she could kind of get the men over on her side. So she was like this constant, that was her deal. Her go-to was her sexuality, right? And, you know, and so the boys all liked her, and she was legitimate. Easy, right? So Nanny's mama, Lou, she pretty much knew about her daughter's escapades, but she didn't say anything or just try to stop her, because she pretty much figured if Nanny came up pregnant that she could escape her tyrant father, since he'd no doubt there'd either be a shotgun wedding or he'd just flat out kick her out, you know?
Right.
So Nanny's father eventually did take notice of a young man who worked with her at this linen factory. And this guy's name was Charlie Bragg.
Okay.
And this Charlie's main preoccupation, even above Nanny, was his mama. Now, y'all know what it's like to have a mama's boy. So his paycheck supported his mama, and he treated the old lady like the queen of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So James Hazel, Nanny's stepdad / daddy, thought this was great. You know, good old fashioned respect for his elders, something his own daughters could learn from. And within 4 months in 1921, he'd married Nanny off at 15, whether she wanted to or not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think he had some sort of ulterior motives, thinking the boy was, you know, going to help out that family by pulling him in was not getting rid of her, but gaining. And also being married that age, you know, a lot of times they just needed to get rid of them too. My great-grandmother married off, I think, at 13. Oh, my God.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but she was also escaping a bunch of stuff. But anyway, so it soon turned out that Nanny had traded her controlling, abusive father for a pretty much equally controlling yet cunningly manipulative mother-in-law. If Nanny wanted to go out or do something that the elder Mrs. Bragg didn't want to, she would feign a dizzy spell or a stomach cramp until her son, Charlie, was forced to relent and they would stay home.
Right.
So, and get this, she wouldn't even let, if Nanny's own mama came over, she wouldn't ever, she would never let her stay the night or stay very long. Get out.
Oh, jeez. Well, I guess she, maybe if she was abused like that when she was a kid, maybe she held her responsible for some of it.
No. I'm saying that Mrs. Bragg wouldn't let Nanny's mom
I totally misunderstood.
Stay. Yeah. So, no. I got it wrong. No problem. But anyway. So, yeah, you know, the old lady was ruling the roost and, you know, so poor girl was feeling a lot of pressure. So meanwhile, so the Braggs had four daughters within a 4-year period, of course, boom, boom, boom. And the first girl's name was Melvina in 1923. And then the last child's name was Florine in 1927. So pressures from raising babies and pleasing old monster-in-law Braggs and kicking for a consistently drunk, philandering husband kind of grew until she began to find her own solace in the bottle and stray men at the local gin joints. So things are starting to fall apart for our girl. Early in 1927, the Braggs lost their two middle daughters to suspected food poisoning. There's no proof, but there's pretty much little doubt that their mother, Nanny, consciously did this. And the local medics called
Think that at the time that it happened?
No. Okay. There's a lot of afterthought here. And, you know, they just didn't look into things like that way back then. And,
because they probably had cholera and things like that going on. So they figured.
They just didn't look at it like that. And what mom would kill their child? I mean, really. You know, that's how they look at it. And So the local medics said it was accidental, but Charlie Braggs wasn't convinced. So he kind of was already a little suspicious because he'd been sick now and then and this and that. And she just, you know, her cooking was sometimes on it, sometimes not, right? So he soon bolted and he took the oldest daughter, Melvina, who was his pet.
Uh-huh.
He left and took the little girl and he left the newborn and his own mama behind, which is a little surprising.
Well, he wanted to get away from his mama. She was controlling.
I think he'd pretty much had enough of her business. So then Charlie reappeared in the summer of 1928, almost a year later, with another woman and her child and Melvina in tow. Now, during this time, his mama had passed away, supposedly again from natural causes.
So with a little food poisoning mixed in.
We're just gonna speculate right now. So things got awkward, right? Since Charlie was no prize to begin with, and Nanny took Melvina and Florine, and pretty much amscrayed back to her parents' house.
Right.
So Charlie is the only husband known to escape her special recipe for prunes.
Oh, it was prunes, was it? Okay.
Well, prunes were her proclivity, if I can say that. A proclivity for prunes. And, you know, so she was feeding these kids prunes,
too. She liked to keep them regular.
Exactly. And I mean, it was just like something that, okay, so if you had a problem, you just put it off to, they were prunes, right?
She had too many prunes.
I know it. So still with her head in the clouds of romance, she again started to peruse the Lonely Hearts ads again. I mean, she was like, boom, right on it. And she began to correspond with a 23-year-old factory worker by the name of Frank Harrelson. Now she started sending him cakes.
Oh boy.
And naughty letters.
And naughty letters?
Naughty letters. Sexting old school style, girl, basically. So they were, you know, corresponding some naughtiness. And anyway, so they were married by 1929 and moved back to Jacksonville, Alabama. So she moves around a lot. I don't know why. And I kept trying to find out why, but there's a big path of the South that she gets around. So anyway, the honeymoon was pretty much quickly over when Nanny realized that her tall, good looking husband with the square chin and rugged features of her romance novels was an alcoholic and had spent time in jail for felonious assault.
Well, wasn't she writing it in prison?
No.
Oh, mm-mm. Oh, 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 oh.
No, she just sent him a cake. He was a factory worker. Mm-mm.
Oh, so, okay.
Yeah.
So I'm getting off track here tonight. I don't know.
You're letting your mind wander. When I said she sent him a cake, you're like, okay.
I was on that cake, man. I'm like, what cake? What do I have in the pantry I can make a cake out of?
Uh-huh. No. I think he was more interested in the naughty letters than her cake and in reflection.
Her baking abilities. Yeah.
Probably. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He didn't really care at that point. And oddly enough, this marriage went on for like 16 years. And he was really abusive to her and abusive to the girls, yelling and screaming and terrorizing and pretty much, you know, beating them down physically and emotionally while he was drunk. And he'd have drunken rages. And that was a lot of the time. So let's take a break here because there's something interesting from here on. So
okay.
We will be right back with more.
All right, then.
Because you need to keep your scorecard out. And
we got lots more murders to go.
Mm-hmm. We'll be right back, y'all. We were recently contacted by listener Debbie Berger to get the word about her dear friend Sabrina Cain, who was murdered in 1974 in Belleville, Illinois. Sabrina was a beautiful, bright, sweet, kind, and wonderful young girl who endured more in her 18 years than she really should have. Sabrina was, at age 7, taken from her father, Colin Cain, by her mother and stepfather, Loren and Fred Rourke. Colin only saw Sabrina twice after she left with her mother. When Sabrina disappeared, her father was not informed. He only actually found out about her disappearance after her body had been found. Debbie met Sabrina in high school. Over those 4 years, she changed from the vivacious girl described above to a quiet, fearful girl who clearly had problems at home. Sophomore year, she started showing up with bruises on her arms and legs. She wouldn't talk about it or tell anyone in authority because of her stepfather. He was a local cop. She said, Fred, her stepfather, would kill her if she told anyone. But Debbie would hear that things were getting much worse. They met again the fall after graduation, and Sabrina was working at a local grocery at night. Sabrina shared with Debbie that she had been planning on moving out and getting her own apartment. She said she hated Fred and couldn't be in the same house with him anymore. The following week, Sabrina wasn't there. No one knew where she was. Questions to her parents went unanswered. Sabrina disappeared on the 5th of February. She was staying with another high school friend who was helping her look for an apartment. On that day, her stepfather, Fred, picked her up from the friend's apartment and she was never seen again. The friend's husband saw Sabrina in her own car being driven by her stepfather, Fred. She wasn't reported missing until the middle of March. Her body was found floating in a pond just 3 miles from Fred Rourke's house. Her hands were tied behind her back and she was weighted down with a cement block. She'd been shot in the back, chest, upper arm, and finally in the back of the head. She was shot with a .38 caliber gun. Rourke's .38 turned up missing the day her body was found. The police allowed him to search the area where she was found. The police never searched her home or the rehab home the family had lived in previously. A friend of Sabrina's said she saw a large pool of blood under a throw rug on the carpet in front of Sabrina's closet. She was too afraid to tell the police, so by the time she did tell, the rug had already been removed and disposed of. The police never attempted to find the rug. Rourke was called to identify Sabrina's remains and aided investigators in the early stages of the murder investigation, but lost his job as a police officer after he refused to take a lie detector test about the killing. The only person indicted for the murder was Sabrina's stepfather, Fred Rourke. A jury found Rourke not guilty in a two-day murder trial at the Adams County Courthouse in Quincy. He was found not guilty due to lack of evidence. Rourke was killed 4 years later in a truck accident. Sabrina's half-sister, Kimberly Kane, and Debbie have been trying to bring awareness to her case. They both feel that Fred Rourke murdered her and continue to seek justice for Sabrina. Whoever murdered Sabrina, Jean Kane, has never been held responsible for the crime. If you'd like to know more or help keep Sabrina Jean Kane's memory alive, you can reach Debbie and Kimberly at Justice for Sabrina at Facebook.
Okay, y'all, welcome back. And Lark is going to continue her tale of the granny who giggles and poisons.
Oh, sorry. So by the 1940s, the surviving daughters, remember, are Melvita and Florine. Mm-hmm. They had grown up and they were the daughters from the first marriage. And they'd grown up and gone on and gotten married themselves. Okay, so Melvita.
Okay, so quite a bit of time has passed then.
Yeah, remember, she was married to the second husband for 16 years. And right. In this amount of time, the girls were already big when she got, not big, but they were
older. You know, yeah.
Yeah, they were older enough that during this time, they're marriageable-ish. Well, anyway, so Melvita, remember, who is basically her first, well, she is her first daughter. And Florine is her fourth daughter. They'd grown and they'd married. Now, Melvita had a son, and the son's name is Robert. And the little boy was born in 1943. And in February of 1945, Melvita was pregnant again, but she was having a pretty hard labor, and so her husband went and fetched Nanny and called her to come to the hospital and comfort the daughter. And so Nanny dutifully showed up, and she spent the entire birth soothing and attending Melvita. And within an hour of that baby girl's birth, she was dead.
Melvita was?
No, the baby.
The baby was?
The baby. Oh. The baby Aww. Was dead. Aww. Now, and now here's what happened.
I'm not going to like this.
No, sorry. Exhausted from the labor and groggy from the ether that they used to give them back then, Melvita thought she saw her mother, who was cradling the newborn, stick a hat pin into the baby's head.
Oh, my word.
Mm-hmm. Now, she wasn't sure if it was a dream or a vision or whatever, because she was kind of high, if you know what I mean. And right. later, when she asked her husband and her sister for clarification, they said that they noticed when Nanny came out and announced that the child was dead, she was holding a hat pin.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So the doctors couldn't give a positive explanation on why
you can't
the child
see a
died.
Hat pin hole in the kid's head.
I guess they didn't look, you know what I mean? And then, yeah. And like I say, everybody was a little tired and probably excited and who knows what, but yeah. So the doctors just couldn't explain. So moving on. So the grieving parents drifted apart and Melvita started dating a soldier and Nanny didn't approve. She totally disapproved of this guy. And so at one point, while Melvita was visiting her father after a particularly nasty fight with her mom, the son, mm-hmm. remember Melvita had a son?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Nanny was babysitting and he died mysteriously under Nanny's care on the 7th of July in 1945. So the death was diagnosed as asphyxia.
Wait. He died in Nanny's care.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. So she had a big bust up with her mom, and Melvina went off to visit her dad. Remember, Melvina was the pet of.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So she went off to visit her dad after having this fight with her mom. For some reason, she left the little boy and So anyway, he was diagnosed as having asphyxiated from unknown causes. So here's
a pillow over the face will do.
Yeah. Well, she's starting to wise up because she's figured out now that, okay, so they go to the funeral, they go to the grave. She's wailing and fainting at the gravesite. And then 2 months later, she collects a $500 life insurance that she'd taken out on the little boy.
Oh, jeez.
So she's starting to figure some stuff out here and put it all together. So I think she was really just warming up on the children and the grandchildren, you know, because this time she learned that she needed to take those policies out. So in August of 1945, Japan had surrendered, bringing the end of World War II, in case you don't know your history. So a little bit after, a couple weeks after, on the night of September the 15th in 1945, Frank Harrelson, her current husband, went out to the tavern to welcome home some of his soldier buddies from overseas. Well, they tore it up and he came home drunk and mean, and he proceeded to rape Nanny over the kitchen table.
Oh, jeez.
Well, you know.
Well, that would trigger you, I guess, you know.
Because this was like the last straw for her. And so the next day after, you know, he thought everything was fine and Danny, the next day she found his corn liquor jug hidden in the rose bushes. And that just really kind of pissed her off even more, I think, than the rape, because she loved her roses and she was annoyed that they were this jug was in her bushes. So she tops it off with rat poison. She tops it off with rat poison, shook it up, and by the end of the night,
he was dead
as a toenail, y'all. So he died in excruciating pain, and he was just 38. So,
oh wow.
So Nanny washed that jug out and went on about her business. Moving on.
Moving on to the next guy.
Moving on. So
next, take it.
Next is husband number three. So in 1947, 2 years after burying our buddy Frank, Nanny met and married Arlie J. Lanning in North Carolina, and she marries husband number three, 3 days after meeting him. Three days. Mm-hmm. Now,
it was love at first sight. She just loved the idea of having a policy on this guy.
Well, yeah, because he managed to avoid the stewed prunes for about 5 years before she 86'd him. But just before he died, a nephew who was living with them precursed this and died of food poisoning, you think?
Food poisoning. Yeah, it was food poisoning, all right.
She
poisoned the food.
Oh, yeah. So soon after these deaths, the couple's house that they lived in, and husband number three lived in this house, which had been left to Lanning's sister right after all these people died, the house burned down. Well, okay, follow me here. It was left to the sister, but it burns down mysteriously, so the insurance money went to Nanny.
How convenient.
Right, yeah, so she quickly banks this cash, and after Lanning's mother also dies in her sleep, this is the second mother-in-law, okay? After this mother-in-law dies in her sleep, then she leaves North Carolina, and she ends up back at her sister Debbie's home. Well, guess what? Debbie was bedridden, so soon after Nanny's arrival, she dies! Go figure! I know. Okay, so we're just knocking them out of the park here. So looking for yet another husband, Nanny joins a dating service called the Diamond Circle Club. And soon after, she meets Richard L. Morton of Jamestown, North Carolina. Now, they marry in 1952 in Emporia, Kansas. Now, he didn't have a drinking problem, but he was an adulterous dude. So before she poisoned him, she poisoned her own mama. So she poisons her own mama.
Why?
Louise.
For insurance money again?
Well, I think so. I have to, yeah. Yeah. Okay, wait. There's a whole lot of money coming here in a second. So she poisons her mama, Louisa, on January the 1953 because her mom had come to live with the two of them. And, I guess she didn't need that drama in her life. So and she poisons her mom and he dies 3 months later on May 19th of 1953. So she's whipping through them at this point, right? Y'all need a scorecard yet? You need a scorecard?
Well, yeah. My question is, why isn't anybody questioning the fact that she's had all these people related to? I mean, this goes back to like the Taco Bell killer that we did a few weeks ago.
I know.
Well, this guy was killing people that he knew and that he worked with, and they still didn't put two and two together. So it sounds like Granny's in the same position. She's killed her whole family and nobody's put it together yet.
Well, yeah, I have some couple of questions later about that too. So we'll go back to that in a second. But so because of all this right here, what we just mentioned about, about poor Mr. Richard Morton would be husband number four.
Right.
And mama.
Right.
So Nanny collected, get this, five life insurance policies on him. At the time, they were only $1,400 at the time, but approximately $10,600 adjusted for the inflation of over those years. So, you know, our girl is really getting hip to insurance policies and the power of prunes.
It's like the monkey in Indiana Jones that eats the dates. They just keels over, you know?
I know.
So don't y'all eat need the to dates. Think, don't eat yeah, the prunes.
The power of prunes, man. I'm telling you. So next and final, not that she didn't try again, but this is the next man. She married a man by the name of Samuel Doss of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Now, she married him in June of 1953. Now, she just never lets any grass grow under her feet. So
seriously. How many states is this now? Like 5, 6?
Golly, I don't know. At least. Because she's been like all over the place. Yeah. She's been, she's been in North Carolina. She's been in Alabama. She's been in Oklahoma, Kansas. Yeah, I can't even keep up. So next, she marries him in June of 53. And he was a Nazarene minister who had lost his entire family in a tornado.
Oh, wow.
In Arkansas. Now we
well,
can
it
all
happens frequently in Arkansas. I'm very familiar with beneath the bed and under the mattress and in the bathtub. Yeah.
Well, absolutely.
It happens a lot.
So we both know about this. I mean, there is a tornado alley. We know about this. And so I don't know that he traded up by going to Oklahoma. But anyway, so Sam disapproved of the romance novels and stories that his wife just adored, right? And radio and television were products meant to enrich the mind, which meant that comedies and love stories were like totally taboo, right? So bedtime came, you're going to love this. Bedtime came promptly at 9:30 and he followed his agenda on, you know, like clockwork, and he expected her to adhere to it too. And get this, Miss Sex Machine herself. Sex was pre-scheduled. Oh no. Oh God. Oh no, it wasn't. Pre-scheduled sex.
At 9:25.
I love it. Oh no, they weren't in bed till 9:30. So hey. Wait a minute. Don't get ahead of yourself. So spending patterns, you know, came hard line too. You know, one never used the electric fan until temperatures exceed the unbearable, which we know they can be.
Exactly.
And lights from room to room were frugally used. You turn it on only when you're entering, you turn it off immediately when you leave. Of course, I do that too, but
I do that, yeah.
And then when reading,
turn the lights off.
I know. Hey. So in reading, not like she really read a lot. I think she looked at a lot of pictures, but only the reading lamps behind the easy chair would be turned on. And otherwise, there was like a darkened chamber. Furniture was costly, so doilies were prevalent to preserve the upholstery.
Like that.
Well,
I kind of like sitting in the dark, Clark.
I bet you're sitting in the dark right now, aren't you?
I am. There are no lights on.
Oh, but I can tell you something funny, just on a side note. My godmother's father, who all these people are from LaGrange, Texas, okay? My godmother's father used to have one light bulb hanging from the middle of the house. And when he went to bed, he unscrewed the light bulb to the living room. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. And guess what? You know what? This woman is a big time winemaker now. So she has come to greatness. I love my godmother, by God. So anyway, so back to our girl. So when Pinching the Pennies and the Die Hard Living came, you know, just became overbearing, Nanny finally snapped and she pulled out that prune pie recipe. Yum, yum, yum. So here we go. And in late September, Sam was admitted to the hospital with flu-like symptoms. And the hospital diagnosed a severe digestive tract infection. So he was treated and released on October the 5th. And Samuel died on October the 12th in 1954. Well, Nanny killed him as soon as he got out of the hospital.
Well, of course she did.
Yeah, because she was in a rush to collect two life insurance policies that she'd taken out on him, right? Okay. So this time, the sudden death alerted his doctor, and he ordered an autopsy.
Good. So finally, somebody's got some sense in there.
Well, you're kind of moving into a little more
modern times.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and not so much in the sticks anymore, because, you know, she was living way out in the middle of nowhere, kind of sort of.
Right. Well, they probably didn't have a local doctor unless you went into town. Yeah.
Right. And so people dying, they didn't really bother too much. Just bury him and carry on. So anyway, so this sudden death alerted the doctor, and the autopsy revealed a huge amount of arsenic in his system. Well, go figure.
Yes, that is the main component of rat poison.
Hello. So our Miss Nanny was promptly arrested. And so I love it. I just love this part too. Okay. So even though our Sam wasn't dead yet, she'd already been corresponding to somebody else.
Oh.
And several days after Nanny's arrest, a man by the name of John Keel stepped forth from North Carolina. So she's back and forth all over the place. North Carolina was pretty good stomping grounds for her hunting territory.
Seems to be. She's chewing them up, number 5 and probably number 6 too.
Well, he stepped forward from North Carolina looking pretty relieved. He was a dairy farmer, and he'd been corresponding with her, and he'd found her ad in the Lonely Arts Club. So she told him that she was already a widow and yearning for a good man with whom to settle. And she had sent him, too, another homemade cake. Now,
Reel them in with the baked goods and take them out with the baked goods too.
Exactly. Hey, why blow a good tactic? So anyway, his Keel was relieved that the cape hadn't really been his favorite, which was apple and prune, or else he might have keeled over too.
Oh, jeez.
I'm sorry.
We are not, by the way, publishing the recipe for Giggles O'Grady to her prune pie.
See,
we are not publishing her recipe.
I've got the recipe and everything, y'all. That's just no fun, Kim. She might change her mind. So y'all check back on the blog. I'm going to have my say in this. Anyway, okay, so after a whole lot of grilling by the police and flirting on her side, because she was just flirting to beat the band. Oh, flirt, you know, giggling, being that little giggly girl. Finally, she confessed.
Wow.
She confessed. She had even okayed the autopsy for Sam, which nobody seems to really understand why she did it, other than maybe she thought she was caught at that point. They don't know. But anyway, I personally think that she was swept up in all the attention and, you know.
Right. More attention. A trial would be a lot of attention.
Anyway, so later they continue. They came to the decision that they were going to exhume all of the other people. They started looking back, and they actually ultimately figured out that they thought she killed all of these people except for her two daughters. And she actually did. She confessed to all of them. She confessed to killing 4 of her husbands, her mom, 2 of her sisters, her grandson, 2 of her mother-in-laws.
Oh, jeez. And the list goes on and on.
The granddaughter, and even though the state of Oklahoma was centered around Samuel Doss's case,
right.
And she was actually only prosecuted for his case, which I don't know why, but I tried to find that out, and I think it was just too much, you know what I mean? When was good enough for them, get her in jail, and that was that. So,
well, yeah, they had enough on her to leave her there a good long time, if not stick her in the gas chamber, so.
So to wrap all this up, our nanny was prosecuted by J. Howard Edmondson, who later actually became the governor of Oklahoma. She pled guilty on May 17th, 1955, and was sentenced to life imprisonment because the state did not pursue the death penalty, i.e. the electric chair, because of her sex. So they didn't want to be frying women up in there. And she was actually, like I say, never charged with any of the other deaths, just the death of her last husband, the Reverend Sam. And ultimately, she died from leukemia in the hospital ward of the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in 1965.
Wow.
Yeah.
She probably got leukemia from messing around with arsenic all that time.
Well, you're the chemist, so you're probably right, you know. Now, I have a really weird little interesting trivia moment here about her. One of her relatives by the name of Sherby Green, who did a whole bunch of genealogy and contributed to a lot of the information, and I really think the quote-unquote legend of our nanny. And one of the people that she kind of took their family back to was actually Abraham Lincoln's family.
Wow.
So I know. So that's some ancestry.com, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
So I don't know. You have any questions? One of the things that I really went down the rabbit hole on this because I got to thinking, you know, like, what do you call someone who serially kills their family? Like,
I guess it's familicide, just like it was for the case we had a couple weeks ago.
Well, I don't know. I kept trying
Gene
to find
Simmons.
All this. Yeah.
I mean, his was a spree killing and hers was almost a serial killing over a longer amount of time, but it's still familicide because she killed her relatives. She didn't kill, you know, she killed husbands and family members. So
right. She never went outside that box. And So I started to look up some different things and I really got a little more confused because there's all kinds of stuff. Parasite is killing both your parents. And then what is it if you kill your mother-in-law? And what is it if you kill only your children? I mean, it's golly, it gets, there's,
right.
Yeah, there's words for everything. But I don't know. I think there were a whole lot more women that did this than ever got caught way back then.
Oh, for sure. For sure there were. And a lot of them were just finding out in modern times that we're back in the 1800s, 1700s, because we can recognize the signs of arsenic poisoning. And, you know, when we read a description about what happened to this person, we're like, oh yeah, that's probably what it was. You know,
exactly. Well, her downfall, in my opinion, was the insurance policies, because nobody twigged until, you know, she was pushing the issue. And she pushed the issue with her last husband because she was in a hurry to get the insurance policy. So that's
right.
Really how
I think I would have been suspicious when she had five policies on one husband. I mean, I think that would have made me a little suspicious.
Who knows? I mean, you know, those people, I don't know. As far as insurance goes, I figure they wanted to sell as many policies as they could. They didn't care.
Well, thank goodness for the doctors that said something just ain't right.
Yeah.
We need to look in this a little bit further. So.
Yeah, because poor Mr. Keel was already on his way.
Right.
She already had him, you know, all teed up with his
prune and apple cake. She probably had the next three or four queued up, baking them cakes, getting them primed.
She probably did. You just never know. But anyway, so I hope you think that. I hope you had a fun time.
I loved that one. That was a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun.
I know. So I'm glad everybody was here with us today. And if y'all have any suggestions or story ideas, please hop on over to our blog and let us know.
Let us know on Twitter. You can tweet us. Let us know.
And, that's right.
We would love suggestions if you've got a case that you think hasn't been covered enough and they haven't talked about enough. So, you know, we'd love to uncover it and dig into it.
So for now, that's our day.
All righty then.
Y'all see you soon.
A good week.
Bye.
Bye. That's our episode for this week. Thanks for listening to us, and we hope you join us again every Tuesday for an exciting new episode.
Head on over to our blog at kudzukillerspodcast.blogspot.com and leave a comment or your ideas about the subject this week.
Or follow us on Twitter at kudzukillerspod, and you can shout out to us anytime or send a question for our next Q&A.
Yes, ma'am. And we'd love you forever if you leave us a review on whatever podcast blows you scared at. We'd love to hear what you think of our little show.
If you'd like to become a part of the Kudzu Killers family, hop on over to patreon.com/kudzukillerspodcast and take a look at the goodies you get when you show us some love.
That's right. And if you love our music, check out Jody Jennings Music on Facebook, SoundCloud, or all social media and streaming music platforms.
So until next week,
or if we decide to shoot out a mini episode,
bye y'all.
Bye, y'all.